On this week's 51%, an emergency room nurse marries her skills with those of her famous musician husband, bringing together music and healing.
We want to make sure that the individual who's nominated is surrounded by the people that are important to them the most so they can really let go and have fun and have that special night together.
We'll learn about a woman's experience with peer support and recovery from addiction. Plus, we get a perspective on the hopes raised and dashed for an Indian gymnast. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Life is better with you. Some days are better than other days. But these days, life is better with you. Some days are better than other days. But these days, life is better with you. Life is better. Tell me what you want, I'll give you all that you need. With my heart, my hands, saying please, baby, please. Because nobody does that thing and do better than you.
This week, we bring you another installment of the 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in Napa Valley, California. She also blogs for the Huffington Post. And this week, Ufberg interviews a registered nurse with a background in emergency and relief work, Sarah Aga Franti, who has chosen to dedicate her life to making a positive impact on the lives of others. Franti's passion has driven her to pursue a master's in public health, and she hopes to use that platform to effect changes in policy development. In August 2013, she and her husband, musician Michael Franti, founded Do It for the Love, bringing together the world of music and healing. The Do It for the Love Foundation provides live concert experiences to adults in end stages of life-threatening illnesses, children with severe challenges, as well as wounded veterans. Since being founded in late 2013, the Do It for the Love Foundation has granted more than 600 such concerts. Ufberg begins by repeating Sarah Aga Franti's mantra.
Be your best. Serve the greater good. Rock out wherever you are. Oh, Sarah, that's such a wonderful mantra.
How are you?
I'm good. I'd like to steal that for myself. I'm so enamored with the Do It for the Love Foundation. I've seen it in action, and I would just love to hear what inspired you and Michael to take on such an ambitious project as this foundation.
Yeah. Well, just for the record, you can absolutely adopt that mantra for yourself. It's all yours. we give it to you. I grew up my whole life being taught the importance of living a life of service. And the importance of being back to your community and serving the relationships throughout your life. And so it was only natural when Michael and I decided to become partners in life to want to be able to do something together. And we weren't quite sure what that was going to be, but we always knew that intention was set when we made that commitment. So in August of 2013, it was April 21st, and we were in Florida Music Festival, and prior to the festival date, Michael was getting a lot of tweets from a couple. Their account was Hope for Steve, and so it's a couple, a wife named Hope and a husband named Steve, and Steve was living with ALS. And the day before the festival, Michael was saying, have you seen my retweets all the time that I'm doing? He's like, they're going to be at the festival tomorrow. And, of course, being an emergency room nurse, I'm always curious with the story. And so I said, well, let's find out who they are. And we went on their website, and they had a really beautiful story and wedding video. And, when Steve was diagnosed, he had just started dating Hope. And he said, there isn't a very good prognosis. He was given 2 to 5 years to live. And he said, if you want to leave, I understand. And if you don't, will you marry me? So it was really emotional for us. And so when we saw Steve the next day with Hope at the festival, Steve was now in a wheelchair and not able to speak and was whispering words, and we were reading his lips. And we took him at the side of the stage, and Hope was saying, this might be Steve's last show, and he really wants to meet you. Your music inspires him. And so we wanted to really give them a full-on experience. And so we had them on the side of the stage, and Michael has a song called Life is Better with You, which he wrote for me, and he invited them out on stage and introduced 20,000 people to Steve. And so in that moment, he no longer became the guy in the wheelchair, and he was known for the individual who he is and not the disease that he's living with. And there was a moment in the song when Steve whispers to Hope, I want to get up and dance. And Hope pulls him up, and someone in the audience captured this amazing picture, which we have on our website now. And I'm crying, and Michael's crying, and the audience is crying, and they're having this really life-changing moment. And it was very emotional, and Michael and I went home that night, and we thought,
this is it. This, we can do this for thousands of people. We have the capacity. This brings the medical background that you have, the medical world, and this brings the music world that he has. And, you know, through my work, I'm able to understand that illness is family-centered. It affects more than just the individual as well. And that's really important for us too, for the foundation. So that's how it happened. And now we're turning 3 in August, which is pretty amazing that we're not even quite 3 years old yet. We're pretty proud of everything that we've been able to achieve and the lives we've been able to touch so far.
Well, boy, as a toddler, you're doing amazing stuff. I mean, over 600 live concert experiences is pretty extraordinary. And I think that, you know, for someone who's had the good fortune of witnessing it in action, it's so inspiring to see how authentic and how good people feel and how transformed they really are by the music, and everybody gets to really celebrate that. You know, I know you must have so many stories that really reflects the impact of this work on some of the people that you've touched. Do you have a few favorites you might share?
Yeah, you know, we get we always try to get testimonials back about the experiences, and a lot of the feedback we get is, you know, we were able to get a night off. I was able to forget about my problems and just enjoy my time with my family. You know, there was a story of a man who came up to me, and this just sort of puts into perspective what these moments mean. But it was an individual who came up to me and said, you know, my mom was living with stage 4 breast cancer, and she really wanted to see the Dixie Chicks. And I wasn't a big fan, but I took her anyway. We went anyway. And she's since passed, and it's my favorite memory that we have together. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to me. And some of our recipients end up passing away, and some of them don't. And, you know, and so we're about creating these lifelong memories. You know, I, as a nurse, I thought I knew that illness was family-centered. And then when my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer 1.5 years ago, and being her primary caregiver through her chemo, I really understood what that meant, and the stress and the emotional roller coaster that the caregivers go on. So through this foundation, we've had really incredible connections with the individual, with the family. And then the third one that was sort of unexpected but a positive outcome is that the artists come back to us. Since we do live wish grants with any artist, you can write to us and see any artist, any genre of music. And they'll write back to us and say, that was super inspiring. We're so happy to be part of the work the foundation does. It just reconnected me to what I do, why I do what I do. And that's really incredible for us too, because it was this unexpected outcome. And so now we're reaching all levels through our wish grants to people's hearts.
I think that it's really important for you to share a little bit more about the fact that you just don't grant the wish to the person that's nominated, but it becomes an experience for several people, the friends and family, to join them, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. So we send the individual and up to 4 friends and or caregivers or family members. So we want to make sure that the individual who's nominated is surrounded by the people that are important to them the most, so they can really let go and have fun and have that special night together.
So originally it started with just people being able to come to a Michael Franti concert, right? But now it's really expanded to any artist that they wish for, correct?
Well, we always had the intention of including every artist, but I kind of used Michael as the guinea pig the first 3 months. So we had the idea in April. We have an incredible community who wanted to jump on board and get us going right away. And so we had our first fundraiser and our website and splash page and video by August of 2013. And so we thought, okay, Michael, let's just do these wish grants through you for the first 2 months. Let's push you so that we can really get the system streamlined, so that when other artists come on board, it's really easy for them. We know as artists, they're busy. They're giving out a lot of energy in their performances and all their other work. And so we wanted to make it really easy for them to jump onto the mission that we do. So we do all the work for them. We contact the tour managers, we get the tickets straightened out so that it's really super easy for them. So you'll see that in the beginning, Michael did lots of wish grants to make sure that we had it down right, so that when we started expanding, it was really great for the recipients, the family, and the artists.
That's really wonderful. I, you know, it's amazing to me that you've been able to you know, create such huge momentum in such a short amount of time, especially given that, you know, you have very busy lives. Michael tours, he's just put out a new, you know, a new record. He, you know, it's not the only thing that you two do. And so I'm just wondering, what plans do you have for continuing to expand the project? Kind of what's going on with the Do It for the Love Foundation for 2016, 2017?
Yeah, it's, you know, I really believe that music is a universal language, and I think that's what I give credit most to. People are able to relate to the power. You know, when you go to a show and that favorite song comes on, the person next to you automatically becomes your best friend, and you're all singing the same words. And I really believe that's why people really resonate with the mission of the foundation. Our target this year for 2016 is to complete 400 wishes, so reach 400 families, and we've completed 140, and we have 200 in the pipeline, so that's going to be completed. So we're right on target, and we've done over 600 since our birth, since August of 2013. So we just want to keep going to expand it. You know, people ask us, like, where do you see Do It for Love going? And right now we just want to hit as many people as we can and bring these memories and life-changing moments to as many people as we can.
So how are you supporting this work? You know, do you have outreach efforts? How do you actually, you know, what kind of things are you doing to actually bring in the resources that you need to create these kinds of wish-granting opportunities?
Yeah, that was a good experience for me as chair of the foundation. You know, my background being nursing and nonprofit work, it's been a great learning experience to see how do you motivate communities and people to support your cause. So we do have fundraising events, and we have a fundraising event coming up on September 21st at the Fairmont in San Francisco called the Do It for the Love Rockers Ball, and it's our first annual gala, which we're super excited about, and that'll be benefiting Do It for Love. So all proceeds are going to be given back to the foundation, so it'll be a fundraising night. And then also, if you want to join as a sponsor, you can sponsor certain specific programs that we work on. You can be community partners. You can be cause marketing partners. And then we also really believe in grassroots community engagement. And so I love, you know, the foundation started on an emotion that Michael and I had. And we love seeing Do It for Love inspire that same fire in other people and in other communities. And so if you want to organize your own fundraiser in your community, we're all for it, and we support it. And the people part of our organization will support you and walk you through it and send you material and temporary tattoos and help you really pump it up. So,
ooh, tattoos. Okay, I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if people, you can help people figure out how can others really nominate someone for a wish. There might be people that actually would love to nominate someone to have this opportunity. Can you share how people can connect with you in that way and how to connect with, you know, the foundation directly?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can go straight to our website. It's doitfortheLove.org. There's a nomination page, electronic nomination page, and you can go on there. And if there's someone you want to nominate and you don't know who they want to see, that's okay. We'll reach out to them and get that information. So I don't want to let that discourage anybody. And also, if you want to go on our social media, we share stories, wish grant stories every day, and updates on what we're working on. And so just spreading the word and sharing the message is also really important for us. So we're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And then, again, you can go straight to the source, doitfortheLove.org, and contact us there. And we'd love to hear from you.
Sara Agafronte, you're doing beautiful work. Thank you so much for taking the time to come out
Thank
and talk
you.
To us today. This is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Few states have been harder hit by the nation's opioid epidemic than Missouri, which has one of the country's highest overdose rates. A new center in the southwest corner of the state is responding by training people living in recovery to help others do the same. Side Effects' Bram Sable-Smith reports on why we may see more centers like this open across the country.
43-year-old Dina Kilpatrick came to Branson, Missouri, looking for a new start. She'd battled drug and alcohol addiction for 30 years, since she was 13. When she moved, she was determined to stay away from all that. And it was going pretty well, she says, but it was lonely.
once I stop drinking and drugs, once you stop polluting yourself, you're just like, who am I? What am I going to do?
Then a few months ago, she relapsed and got a DUI, her fourth. She could have been locked up for 4 years, but she opted to enter the county treatment court. It's a program for nonviolent offenders to get them into recovery instead of prison. For 18 months, she's required to attend a 12-step program, meet with a counselor, a parole officer, complete community service. And she'll also get something she didn't have when she was trying to go it alone, peer support.
So you said you don't have a driver's license. Have you lost it because of a DWI or you just don't have one?
I've lost it due to DUI, my fourth one.
Okay. Do you need housing?
Yes.
Do you need food?
Yes.
Kilpatrick is getting a needs assessment at the Peeps and Recovery Center. It's a peer support center in Reed Spring, about 20 miles from Branson. Sally Moore is doing the assessing, and like all eight of the specialists here, she's in recovery herself from drug addiction.
I don't think that any addict or alcoholic should die in their addiction. And there was somebody there to help me, so.
More than 220 people have already passed through PEEP since it opened in January, which says something about the need here, considering the center serves a population of only about 100,000. PEEPs is like a complement to 12-step programs, but with more specific kinds of support by trained and credentialed peer specialists. Here's Patricia Sams, PEEPs' founder.
We're going to cover all of the life skill areas that people may be shaky at.
Take debt. Many people entering recovery will owe money for medical bills or back taxes or court fees, and that can be overwhelming. So a peer recovery specialist might sit down with the person and say,
okay, so here's your debt and here's your income. And then let's make a payment plan.
That may seem simple, but this support is meaningful coming from someone who shares a similar life experience. And according to Tom Hill of the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration,
the bottom line is that peers can help improve treatment outcomes.
But few states are funding these peer services, at least not through Medicaid. Back in 2007, the Federal Medicaid Agency urged states to start paying for peer support for mental health patients and for substance abuse patients. And while more than 30 states have started paying for mental health peers, Hill says only a handful that don't include Missouri pay for peers to help with addiction.
Part of that is just based on the history of mental health being Medicaid reimbursable for many, many years, whereas substance use disorders and treatment for that has not been.
As public awareness of the opioid epidemic grows, Hill expects more states to start paying for substance abuse peers. But for now, centers like PEEPS have to find other funding to help people like Dina Kilpatrick.
It was kind of a divine intervention for me, you know, be able to find this place and get a second chance.
So far, she's been sober since mid-May and moved in with a family member closer to Reed Spring to pursue her recovery. Bram Sablesmith, Side Effects Public Media.
This story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a news collaborative covering public health. The Rio Olympics are over, along with medal hopes for an Indian gymnast, in fact, the first Indian woman to qualify for Olympic gymnastics. Sandeep Roy for KALW has more.
On Sunday night, much of India was watching television with bated breath, all for one young woman at the Rio Olympics. Her name is Deepa Karmakar. And a billion people's hopes were resting on her shoulders. She was the first Indian woman to have qualified for gymnastics at the Olympics. And she was going to do the toughest and most dangerous maneuver of all, the front handspring and then double front somersault known as the Pradunova vault. You can break your spine doing it. It's called the death vault. It's, as the Wall Street Journal puts it, a precarious path to the medal platform. Until Deepa Karmakar, most Indians didn't know it existed. On Sunday, as she started running towards the vaulting horse, much of India forgot to breathe.
Deepa Karmakar, the first female Indian gymnast to ever qualify for the Olympic Games, the first Indian gymnast, male or female, to ever reach an Olympic event final. Fifth place on the vault at last year's World Championships.
She also does the Pradunova 7.0 difficulty, the front handspring.
This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. She landed, she scored 8.6, the country exhaled. But in the end, it was not enough. She lost out narrowly in the medal hunt and came in fourth. Simone Biles of the USA got another gold.
I'm just Simone Biles. Everything that has led me up to this moment has paid off, and it's all been worth it. I have no regrets.
Deepa had regrets. She told NDTV that it would have hurt less if she had come fifth or sixth.
बहुत बहुत ज़्यादा दुख है मुझे. शायद मैं fifth या sixth में रहता तो मुझे इतना नहीं होता. पर fourth में मैं बहुत दुख.
Deepa Karmakar is a small-town girl from northeastern India. She didn't have a proper vaulting table, just mats piled on top of each other in a gym that flooded during the monsoons. She has flat feet. In her first competition, she had no shoes. She wore an oversized, ill-fitting costume. She only managed to get her Olympic berth in April. Her Pradhanova vault is both a statement of her grit as it is a statement of desperation. Simone Biles came from a tough childhood, but still she does not need to do the Pradhanova vault. I'm not trying to die, she told The New Yorker. Neither is Deepa Karmakar, but she does it to make up for everything else she didn't get on her way to the Olympics. Just trying the vault gets her 7 points. Deepa Karmakar defied all odds in getting to the finals. The same country that watched her with bated breath scarcely cares about investing in infrastructure and training to make anyone succeed in any sport except cricket. Athletes have sold their gold medals to make ends meet. When Duti Chand, the third Indian woman to qualify for the 100-meter sprint in Rio, was flying to Brazil, she tweeted wondering why the athletes made the grueling long journey squished into coach while the officials flew business class. She was not sure she'd have the spikes to run at Rio. What most of us watching Deepa Karmakar on television don't realize is something writer Amitava Kumar spelled out in The New Yorker. Many of the young women on the Indian team are from villages in the Indian hinterland, several of them members of the Indian Aboriginal population. Chances are they wouldn't have had the benefits of diet, training, or access to equipment that their opponents easily take for granted. The athletes soldiering on the field is from the poor, disadvantaged strata. Those disappointed, writes Kumar, are often from what used to be called the leisure class. People like me, the urban, educated middle class, pushed to get MBAs to go to institutes of engineering and management. We go abroad to make money and then lament that a country of a billion plus can't bring home a medal. We take it as a personal slight that we have to settle for fourth place. Again and again. P.T. Usha, queen of Indian track, came fourth in the 400-meter hurdles in the 1984 Los Angeles Games. In the 1960 Rome Olympics, Milkha Singh came fourth in the 400 meters. There are biopics about some of these athletes mythologizing the almost won moments. Deepa's fourth now gets added to that tally. It's being hailed as India's pride, but it is India's shame as well. Deepa fails to win a medal, said one headline. But really, Deepa didn't fail India. This 4'11" girl brought a divided nation together for a moment across all party lines. But India, in many ways, failed Deepa Karmakar. The sports minister cheered Deepa Karmakar on Twitter from Rio before she made the Pradhanova vault. The tweet had his picture, not hers, and it managed to misspell her name. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1414.